Several school districts across the state are eagerly anticipating the results of tonight's elections. They're hoping voters approve their request for more funding.
The county Republican Party came out and said, don't vote for any of them. Well, I think that's silly.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, Taser's been making a lot of money on things other than stun guns. An international sculpture conference comes to Phoenix for the first time. Why some investors are looking to experiment with new types of rental communities, and a new commercial that plays to some Scottsdale stereotypes.
We did anticipate that some folks might not be happy with the message, but my philosophy, my personal philosophy on that is lighten up.
Plus, zines in Tempe and dinosaur skulls as musical instruments. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. They say all politics are local. It's election day throughout the state. Arizonans who haven't already mailed in their ballots have until 7 p.m. to weigh in on $1 billion worth of bond initiatives and overrides to fund public school districts. But why do we need these referenda in the first place? And will the need for them change with the new funding settlement? Seeking answers, KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke to one of the state's foremost education experts.
Well, Mark, yeah, it's a lot of money. More than $800 million up for grabs in Maricopa County districts alone. They range from a $228 million bond initiative in Paradise Valley's Unified District to an $18 million override for the Dysart Unified System. Former Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Jaime Molera says voters should decide on the merits of the referendums themselves and not politicize the process.
Bond is for capital. Overrides are really for the budget, the salaries of the teachers. That's primarily where those dollars go into. And so the argument has been from a lot of the school districts is that because of the low funding levels from the state, they have to keep up and pay their teachers and make sure that they're not continuing to lose teachers, which has been a big issue. So their ability to try and keep up with basic inflation has been very difficult. So that's why you're seeing a lot more overrides, and the size of the overrides have been significantly higher.
Does this $3.5 billion funding deal that was just struck last week change the need for these bond and override elections?
Well, I think long term it might, certainly. I think for the immediate future, the school districts would argue that this is a great opportunity for us to make significant progress, but nonetheless, we are still behind in a lot of ways. And so I think they would like to see both of these kind of mirror each other.
Speaking of the settlement, does this make both sides happy? Do you think this accomplishes that goal?
I don't think both sides would ever be happy when it comes to legislative deals. I think the school groups would love to have seen a lot more put on the table. I think the legislature would have liked to have seen, they would argue that less we can't afford as much right now, but all in all, I thought it was a fairly balanced agreement, and both sides recognized the state of the budget and the lawsuit, which required them to deal with this issue.
Did we reach kind of the boiling point here in Arizona with this issue coming to a head? Did we have a watershed moment in Arizona education this past week?
That's a good question. I think the governor really did want to put behind this whole lawsuit issue. That was one of the first things he mentioned when he became governor, is that we want this lawsuit settled and we want to start dealing with, I guess, what he would consider the more academic reform type and finance reform type issues. You couldn't do that with that lawsuit sitting out there, because the school groups would say, how could we even entertain structural change to our academic system unless we deal with some of the basic funding issues that the court is saying that it's unconstitutional.
Do you see this deal helping the state's education coffers get to the level they need to be at?
Well, we're certainly not going to jump from 49 to 32. We might go from 49 to 48. But it's just the nature of our state. We are a growth state. There was a good analysis done by the Arizona Tax Research Association that shows it's hard for Arizona to ever be, or any Western state for that matter, to ever be in the top 10, just because we are continuing to grow. So having said that, we still need to look at a reasonable funding structure on how we make sure that we keep up with growth and we keep up with the real inflationary costs that are out there. And that's the challenge that this helps to momentarily address, but I still believe long-term we need to look at a structural change in how we do the system. A lot of the reason why is because you still have those charter schools and low-income school districts that don't have access to property wealth that other districts, just because of where they're located, do.
As people go out to vote on these overrides, bonds, what would you tell them about if they're daunted, if they don't know what they're voting for, if they're thinking about not going to the polls at all because they really don't understand what's going on? What would you tell them?
Well, A, I hope they vote. I mean, these elections are as important, if not more important, than a lot of the national elections, in my opinion, because it really does affect our economy. It affects our education system. I would hope individuals look at their individual bond and override packages and weigh them on the merits. I was a little disturbed by this blanket statement that the county Republican Party came out with and said, don't vote for any of them. Well, I think that's silly. I think a voter should look at each of their packages that are before them, look at what's being asked of them as a taxpayer, and look at where the money is going. And I think that's part of our democracy. And if the school district did a good job of explaining where that money is going, then I think they hopefully would look at how this could be a good investment for schools.
Taser International, the Scottsdale company famous for producing stun guns and body cameras, released a record earnings report this morning. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, Taser is making a buzz in the technology sector by diversifying into a new field, storage.
It's no shock that Taser is an industry leader in stun guns, which still account for the bulk of the company's production at its headquarters in Scottsdale, Arizona. Taser also makes body cameras. But once officers are wearing those cameras, what are police departments going to do with all that video? Taser's Steve Tuttle says that's where the company stands to make big money in the future.
And that's the back-end cloud that provides the storage, the management, the service, and the sharing of all this data.
Taser's product is called Evidence.com. It costs police departments anywhere from $15 to $99 per month per officer. Steve Dyer is a senior research analyst at Craig Hallam Capital Group who follows police technology. He says while formidable tech companies like Motorola and Panasonic are getting into the body camera industry, Taser's cloud-based service gives the company an edge.
By our count of the top 60 departments, they've lost only two to competitors.
Noah Johnson is a commander with the Tempe Police. His department recently purchased Taser's Axon cameras and is gradually rolling them out across the force. Tempe went with the cloud storage subscriptions because it helps them modernize and organize all their evidence storage.
We were looking for a process not only with the body cameras, but other data that we collect, you know, audio, videos from maybe a 7-Eleven, from an armed robbery, things like that.
Previously, the department's video and audio lived on tape cassettes and DVDs. Tuttle of Taser International explains what its storage system can do.
When you do a recording of an incident, you have the ability to play it back and start filling in the report while you're in the squad car. And those become meta tags, defining what type of crime it was, what violation it was, the person's social security number. All that information can be filled out so that when the video uploads, all that key information is there.
Dyer of Craig Hallam thinks the growth potential for the industry is enormous, especially when cities realize the return on investment when it comes to preventing claims against their police departments. He says the NYPD alone has paid out millions over the past decade over disputed claims.
You could put a camera on every officer in New York City for a fraction of that.
More cameras means more data, and tech companies are lining up to profit from the storage. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ, along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry. I'm Mark Brody. Here's a cultural puzzle for law enforcement. How do you create a way of drawing young people away from extremism and violent radicalization without referencing or offending any of the people or groups, young people, the media, and law enforcement, associate with radicalism? What would you call such a program? How about Don't Be a Puppet?
It's a real name. The FBI came up with it, and the learning tool was scheduled to be released this week, but now that's indefinitely on hold. What could be wrong with puppets? Well, when the completed program was recently shown to community leaders representing Arab, Muslim, and civil rights organizations, they asked that the program be canceled altogether. What does the FBI say? We are, quote, developing a website designed to provide awareness about the dangers of violent extremism, predators on the internet, with input from students, educators, and community leaders. And that's about all they would tell us, that statement. Abid Ayyub is the legal and policy director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Abid, welcome. And you actually view this Don't Be a Puppet program of the FBI's, right?
Thank you for having me on. And yes, I did get an opportunity to review part of the Don't Be a Puppet program.
What was your reaction? What were they trying to achieve? And how, in your view and some of your colleagues' views, do you think they failed?
Well, our initial reaction was surprise, because we were typically, when we work with the any government agency, we're called in at the beginning of a program to offer our advice and expertise on how a program should be developed. This particular meeting, the program was put in front of us and said, here's what we've developed. It's launching. And it seemed that the program as a whole focused on Arab and Muslims, when that's going to stigmatize Arab and Muslim students and cause a problem for many of these students in the schools.
So it didn't refer to Timothy McVeigh, right-wing militia groups, that sort of thing, responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing?
There was a slide with different terror attacks across the world, and it did have Oklahoma City, and it did have Timothy McVeigh. But outside of that slide, I don't recall another portion of the program where it was shown, but the full program as a whole seemed to focus on Arab and Muslims.
The FBI isn't releasing this. They didn't allow us to see any of the slides. Can you give me a sense of the tone of the slides that some of might have found offensive?
The initial homepage, when the student clicks in, it looks like a garage or a workshop, and there's different things they can click on. If you click on the toolbox, it'll say, for example, how to prevent somebody from becoming an extremist, and then it'll have different options. And once you complete each section, there's a puppet that drops down, and a string is cut off from the puppet. And ultimately, when you complete all the section, the puppet runs free, and you get a certificate. And it says, don't be a puppet. Congratulations. The slides themselves were, again, very problematic. And another thing to keep in mind, there were no slides on what to do if somebody brings a gun to school.
Well, let's turn it around for a second and just try to look. I mean, I can't really attest to the frequency of references to Arabs and Muslims and that sort of thing. It sounds like it was pretty lopsided, at least in your impression and the impression of some other groups. But do you have any sympathy for anyone trying to do something like this who is going to have to somehow refer to familiar groups, characterizations, I don't know, ethnicities, historical events, and deliver information and material that's familiar to young people so that they kind of understand what's going on here? You can't do the whole thing with generic Muppets, right?
The issue we have, one of the main issues we have, is the program itself is creating a dangerous precedent of FBI overreach. And these types of programs, they should be managed by experts, teachers, educators, that create curriculum, that could create the information in the best way for the students. And now we're not saying we agree with the website, but if you are to create material to be taught in classrooms, that's not the FBI's job.
Let me elaborate on that just for a moment, because we've also talked with people on the program who say that, you know, when the FBI is accused of surveillance and intrusive monitoring of mosques and community groups and schools as a way of preventing or being proactive about radicalization of youth, we get the message that, well, you know, the FBI should do something more educational. They should stay away from the community places. Is it sort of hard for the FBI to do anything in this situation? I mean, if they're doing this as opposed to surveillance, isn't that possibly a good thing?
I don't think so. I think the FBI doesn't have a role in this. The CVE, you know, we're talking about here is the CVE program, Countering Violent Extremism. Again, coming through this program through a law enforcement lens is dangerous. You're creating distrust with the community. There's not going to be dialogue and cooperation between the community and the FBI on this program. It's best that the community handle the program, the community work on its CVE measures, and the community address issues when they arise within itself. So that's the important thing to keep in mind. The FBI is imposing these programs and imposing the surveillance when there's really, it's really an overreaction. There's really other issues that they could be working on. There's a great focus on Arab and Muslims. And again, what we've seen is that's unwarranted. There's no need for the FBI to take these measures and implement these programs.
If I'm a teacher or a parent listening to this conversation and want to know from your perspective what's out there that actually does, in your view, seriously and appropriately address the question of radicalization, particularly online radicalization, what would you say are the alternatives to this FBI program if it ever does emerge and see the light of day?
Well, I'll tell you, in the U.S., we have many examples of parents who are able to identify if there is an issue and are able to take action. And within the Muslim community, the mosque and the imam and these community centers play an important role. And across the country, these community centers have been supportive, and they've implemented their own programs to lure children away and lure them away from this path and make sure they know exactly what's wrong with going overseas, what's wrong with going down this path of extremism. And rein them in a little bit. So this is the role and responsibility of the community groups, and that's what we've been seeing.
Abed A. Ayoub is the legal and policy director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He viewed the FBI Don't Be a Puppet educational initiative, which is now indefinitely on hold. Abed, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Just ahead, how a rebounding housing market is leading to a new trend in rental investments.
It's very hard to find a bargain below about $250,000. So, you know, a landlord wants to buy a home at the lowest possible price and then rent it out for the highest possible rate.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, accidents 101 northbound at Shea, that's in the East Valley, also 101 northbound at Indian School, and on the 17 northbound, a collision now on the side of the road at Peoria. Look for partly cloudy skies to stick around for the rest of the day. 20% chance of rain. It'll be partly cloudy tonight. Still a 20% chance of showers. Look for overnight lows in the mid to upper 50s. Mostly cloudy skies, at least for the morning tomorrow, turning partly sunny by the afternoon, but not without a 30% chance of showers and storms first. Look for a high of 69 degrees. Right now in Phoenix, looks like some more clouds than sun over at least over Tempe here. It's 78 degrees at KJZZ at 223.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Phoenix, working with breast cancer patients to find the treatment that's right for them with integrative care to support the immune system and reduce pain. CancerCenter.com.
As the population in the Valley grows, so does the demand for rental property, especially single-family homes. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, that demand is leading some investors to experiment with new types of rental communities.
Like many Valley residents today, Elizabeth Rogers isn't originally from Arizona.
Well, I actually moved here from upstate New York.
Today, she's renting a place in Chandler. And for now, a two-bedroom, tan stucco house is home. Rogers likes her granite countertops. Her pug and dachshund have taken a particular liking to the gravel backyard. But Roger's favorite part of the property is that her unit stands by itself.
I'm probably at the age where the noise and the distraction of people above or below or next to is more of an annoyance.
There are several reasons Roger's decided to rent instead of buy a home when she moved to the Valley. But the biggest is financial flexibility.
I wasn't sure what direction my life was going to go in when I moved here as far as how long I was going to be here, so renting was the best option.
And Rogers isn't alone. Demand for single-family home leases is strong right now. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, renter-occupied single-family homes increased about 14% between 2009 and 2013, going from 9.6 million nationwide to just over 11 million. And real estate investors have taken notice.
We've been through a lot of phases over the last few years. The recovery is now complete, but we've ended up with a lot of people wanting low-end homes.
Arizona State University real estate analyst Mike Orr says that market is seeing more investment from larger companies like private equity firms and real estate investment trusts. The trend started around 2012, when the market was still filled with cheap foreclosures from the housing crisis.
It basically started and it was all over in about 18 months.
It's happening all over the country, especially here in Phoenix, one of the areas hit hardest by the housing crisis. But things have changed since 2012, and the market is starting to rebound in the Valley, meaning...
It's very hard to find a bargain below about $250,000. So, you know, and a landlord wants to buy a home at the lowest possible price and then rent it out for the highest possible rate.
These investors are still hoping to grow, though. But faced with shrinking profit margins, some are now looking to options outside of the existing home market.
So if they can't buy them, they have to actually build them.
It's a relatively new business model, but one that's catching on. In Lawrenceville, Georgia, for example, Starwood Waypoint Residential Trust is buying property directly from builders in a new development just outside of Atlanta. But others are taking it a step further and contracting with builders to construct entire neighborhoods. Lennar Homes recently completed a new rental neighborhood near Reno, Nevada. And here in the Valley, Next Metro is about to complete construction on its third development of single-family homes, all zoned to be leased. Josh Hartman is the company's executive vice president.
Part of our business plan is to go into about one market per year, so right now I'm flying up to Denver looking at Atlanta.
By working directly with a builder, investors can have more control over the cost of materials. But Hartman adds the neighborhood concept has other benefits too.
What we're doing is putting 120 to 150 units brand new in one location, and so our maintenance costs are a lot lower.
Rather than sending maintenance crews to properties that are miles apart from each other, a neighborhood allows them to stay in one place, saving money on gas and other travel costs. Hartman adds the business model also makes it easier for them to invest in things like ENERGY STAR ratings.
Definitely a focus of ours to try and keep the efficiency high.
Back in Chandler, renter Elizabeth Rogers says after 15 months in the area, she doesn't regret her decision not to buy a home because she's actually planning another move. This time to Florida.
But still jumping to another house as opposed to an apartment unit or something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Real estate analysts say while no trend is permanent, this demand for single-family rental homes will be sticking around for the foreseeable future. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The 25th International Sculpture Conference opens in Phoenix tomorrow. It was in New Orleans last year. The event is expected to bring artists, museum officials, and others in the art world to the Valley this week. Johanna Hutchison is the executive director of the International Sculpture Center, which is putting on the conference. Johanna, why come to Phoenix?
There's a lot of components that go into it. One thing is we've never done a conference in the Southwest, so since we are an international and inclusive organization, it's important to be part of all the communities that we serve. So we felt coming to an area that we haven't been to before was important. But another factor that goes into it is, what is the community like? Are they receptive? Do they want to work with us? And of course, is there great artwork there? Are there great arts organizations? Is there something that our community would be interested in seeing and experiencing, of course?
What do the folks who come get out of it? I mean, what does it do for them, the people that they're able to meet here?
Well, our conference is not how many people would think of a conference. What we like to feel that we're putting together is a cultural experience where the attendees are experience the community in which the event is taking place. So we have some panels in the mornings, and the rest of the time is made up of workshops that are put on locally by the community and events out in the community. So we may be tapping into something that's already happening, or we may ask artists to open their studio so people can get inside the studios and meet with artists or have a gallery hop or something like that. But it's definitely what we call is a cultural experience.
What kind of impact do you think having the conference in this city will mean for the arts community here after it's over?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because that's always a very important part of us having a conference. It's not about turning up to a city and doing an event and then just going away and never thinking about it again. Great relationships are built at these conferences, and that's the importance of the conference. And I really think about the conferences as just a beginning, a starter or a teaser to what the organization is about, what the community is about. So many things are formed during the conference and carry on after the conference.
Johanna Hutchison is executive director of the International Sculpture Center, which is hosting the 25th International Sculpture Conference in Phoenix. Nihavid Patak will be there. She's a visual artist in the Valley.
Most often artists work in isolation within their studio. So this is a great opportunity to get out and meet with like-minded people and have some inspiring conversations.
Are the people that you tend to meet at events like this people that you would have the opportunity to meet without this kind of conference?
In my opinion, I think it would take a long time and a lot of events separately to make connections and encounter people from diverse group. And to have all of them in one place is quite unique. Also, a sculpture conference gives us a unique opportunity to go behind the scenes. For example, I'm going to be hosting a studio, open studio, which means that people from the conference who are attending the conference will come to my studio. This gives them a rare opportunity to go inside an artist's studio where they can see works which are in between the process. They're not finished. Also, they can see what an artist reads, whether they're clean artists, whether they're clumsy artists. It gives them a lot of information that is not available when we put on shows in galleries and museums. It's a very sterile and a very clean, pristine environment. But studio is where everything happens.
How does it help you, I guess, to be around other artists and see what they're working on and how they're working? I mean, how does that help you in your work?
It's a little bit abstract concept to directly explain. It's not A leads to B or B leads to C. Most of the time, I'm working by myself inside the studio. But every once in a while, there'll be something that I feel excited about or I'm worried about or I'm just want to discuss it with somebody else. And most often, it's hard to discuss with people who are not used to discussing abstract ideas. It could be like purely artistic thing, like how do I make this thing stand without falling apart, like a really technical question. Or it could be more a philosophical question. It could be something about politics. It could be something about the art market. You know, there are so many questions and so many ideas that are so distinct to this world, which there are no answers. There's no MBA for artists. And that's where having a peer group or having like-minded people come together who are supportive and encouraging. Of course, there's a little bit of competitiveness in every field, and that's good, and you know that's reality. But at the same time, beautiful things happen when two people or three people get together and have ideas.
What do you think it says about the Phoenix art scene that this international conference has decided to come here?
Well, I think Phoenix art scene is growing. It has a large group of people who are interested and working very hard to make it a viable and self-sustaining scene. I think we've got some great museums. The architecture and the landscape here is very, very distinct and quite amazing, which frankly, the lot of people outside the Southwest are not aware of. And so because the conference is happening here, it not only focuses on the artist and the art institution, but also the diversity of architects and the landscape in the region.
Nihavid Patak is a Valley-based visual artist. She'll be one of the attendees of the International Sculpture Conference, which starts tomorrow in Phoenix. Coming up, new research into making music. How dinosaur skulls become musical. More on that ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The show is an original production from KJZZ, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, and national and international news to provide a stream of engaging radio. Here in the valley on the freeways, we have a few accidents to tell you about. One on the 101 northbound at Shea, another one on the 101 northbound at Indian School. I-10 eastbound at the 60, lastly I-70 northbound at Peoria. Partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Still a 20% chance we could see some rain today. We could also see a 20% chance of rain tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 50s. Mostly cloudy skies for tomorrow morning. The sun coming out by the afternoon. 30% chance of rain. Look for a high of 69. Right now in Phoenix, it's partly cloudy. 78 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Brophy College Prep. A Catholic Jesuit high school educates the whole person, body, mind, spirit, developing young men for others. Open house Sunday, November 8th, 12:30 to 3 p.m. More at brophyprep.org.
A new type of store dedicated to the print medium will be opening next month in Tempe, selling zines.
It's a published work of stories and ideas and art. It's very do-it-yourself based. There's all kinds of zines. Yeah, self-published.
That's Marna Kay, one of the women behind Wasted Ink Zine Distro. She and fellow co-founder Carissa Lucille joined me to talk about their new venture. I asked Carissa where the idea to open the shop came from.
I would say just sort of a combination of what Marna and I have experienced in the zine scene here in Phoenix, as well as many other zine fests and things all over the United States. And I think we just sort of wanted to make like a more of a home base for zines here in Phoenix.
Marna, how do you envision your space working? Like who do you think will come and what do you think that they'll get out of it?
I hope people from everywhere, all different kinds of walks of life who are just interested in stories and comics and art will come and check out the zine library and shop. What do I envision? I don't know. There's just so many like cool things that we could do with it. But I want it to be like a community space for people to, just kind of let their creative juices flow and maybe be inspired to do their own zine.
It's interesting you talk about a community, because I think for a lot of folks who write zines or publish them, they're a little bit out of sort of the mainstream. And I would imagine that for some, maybe finding a spot like this, a gathering spot, could be a challenge.
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of places here in Phoenix that really adhere to, like, the zine scene. Just now, I think we're starting to see, like, a huge scene kind of develop here. But before that, it was just, it's pretty dry as far as that's concerned. We've been to, like, L.A. and San Francisco and places like that. And there's a lot of people doing their own, self-publications and stuff. It's part of a huge DIY culture where zines come from. And there wasn't a lot of that here in Phoenix, so that's what we want to do, is kind of open that up, and make that easily accessible for people who wouldn't otherwise have that option or, a place to go for something like that.
Carissa, how have you been collecting inventory in anticipation of your opening next month?
Well, I think that is one of the largest challenges we have. Of course, Marna and I both have our own collections of zines that we have accumulated over the years. Marna's collection is much more extensive than my own. But I think that right now, we just put out a call over the internet to hopefully have people donate their zines as well as, bring them to our shop when we're open so that we can increase inventory and just begin to build a sort of very diverse library.
How do you find sort of the writing and publishing scene of zines in the Valley? I mean, are there a lot of people who are doing this here?
There probably are that we don't know about, but like I said, we just recently, are finding that there's a lot of publications that are coming up, within the past year, that are doing their own zines and stuff. And it's really exciting because she and I, we host a zine night on Wednesday nights at the Cartel, and there was just a huge response for it, and it's still going. People still come, and there's some magazines that have sprouted from that, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
Are you making an effort to try to recruit zines from local writers, local publishers, people like that?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's important, especially for Wasted Ink Zine Distro, to not only house zines from all over the United States as well as different countries, but really to show off what Arizona is capable of. There's so much talent here as far as writing and art, comics, political zines. There's a lot here that Arizona has to offer, and it's our goal to sort of highlight that and showcase it.
Mm-hmm. Of the zines that you've read, or maybe that you have so far about Phoenix, about Arizona, what do people write about?
She runs an Arizona zine.
Yeah, I do a zine called B-Sides, and it's basically in response to the negative stuff that surrounds Arizona. You know, I wanted people to live here to kind of be proud of where they live, and those who don't, to know that there's more to Arizona than just Joe Arpaio and angry mongers and bad politics. So B-Sides features all the talented and wonderful people, places, and events that make this, like, seemingly dry desert beautiful and colorful.
Are there other cities that have shops like the one that you guys are planning on opening?
Yes.
Yes.
What do you think that it will mean for this city that we will have one of these now?
I feel like it will show that, you know, we don't have to always consume traditional media, and that there is alternatives to the media that people consume, and you don't always have to be boxed in by the local media, that you can sort of reach out and consume alternative forms. I think it also shows that we're here supporting the local art scene as well as people who aren't necessarily always published. So I think that is an important aspect.
Carissa Lucille and Marna Kay are the co-founders of Wasted Ink Zine Distro, which is set to open early next month in Tempe. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In the 1950s, Phoenix was home to a small record label called MCI. It only lasted for about 7 years, and most of the music the label put out didn't sell especially well. But there was one song in particular that MCI was responsible for that stuck, rockabilly classic The Fool, produced by Lee Hazelwood. Arizona music historian John Dixon recently released a compilation album of some of MCI's music, including The Fool. It's called Martians, Demons, and Fools Like Me, the MCI record story, 1954 to 1961.
Gather around me, buddies.
That's probably what most people know the label for, and over the years, the original pressings of The Fool on MCI have been very collectible, mostly in Europe, but as a hit record, it's played still over and over again on oldies shows. So it was, one could say, the first record that put Arizona on the musical map.
He's fine. He loves her.
Lee Hazelwood is a well-known songwriter, but not necessarily for a lot of people associated with Arizona, but he got his start here. Why did he decide he could find greener pastures elsewhere?
That was because of the success of that record. Dot Records ended up buying the master and assuming that Lee could do more. So they said, hey, kid, how would you like to come over to L.A. and be a producer? And so following the release of The Fool, he ended up in L.A., producing some things over there, but also producing a lot of Arizona acts. But that first MCI recording for Lee really was his ticket out of town and kind of a vindication that as a songwriter, as a producer, he was able to produce very commercially viable music.
Let's go back more specifically to MCI. MCI was, I don't want to say all things to all people, but it's interesting when you have this, when you're putting out something like The Fool, and then you're still having people who come in, hey, you know, I want to give this a shot, or I want to record a commercial there. That's pretty interesting.
Old-fashioned flavor, Aunt Hattie's bread. Real homemade goodness, Aunt Hattie's bread.
Well, and it was. MCI stood for Music Counselors Incorporated. And so in 54, three guys, Connie Conway, Jimmy Wilcox, who were musicians, and a guy named Paul Humley, who was in real estate but a songwriter, incorporated. So really their bread and butter in the early days were kind of your poems set to music. You could go down there with your lyrics and Jimmy and Connie would sit there, write out a lead sheet, and then they would overdub the parts. So they would actually cut a disc of them performing your song. They would have your lyrics written out with a lead sheet. And most of the people, they just said, hi, thank you very much, and that'll be $15 or whatever the charge was, and good luck, you know, in Hollywood. And But occasionally, some among those people that came in the front door was something that they would be interested in.
Well, let's talk about a couple of local singers or things that come to mind for you, because obviously The Fool draws all the attention. I mean, The Fool was a huge hit. But are there certain things, I mean, there's some interesting stuff on this CD, but are there a couple of hidden gems to you, one or two hidden gems that really stand out?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, if you're into sentimentality, Connie Conway's I Should Not Be Seeing You is a killer. I mean, it's just the story of someone in a relationship, and they both realize this should not be going on, but it's going on. It's a sweet arrangement. Connie's delivery is absolutely fantastic.
I should not be seeing you, nor should you be seeing me. We know that it can never be.
From a cultural standpoint, Johnny, we know there's been a lot of progress in the world and in our society over the past 5 to 6 decades. But when it comes to females involved, when it comes to people of color involved, are there examples of that on the disc? Was it just kind of not the way back then?
Well, no, there were a couple of folks. There's a Patti LaSalle, was another young gal who performed all over town at Syatt's Ballroom, was also on television on Channel 5 on the Wallace and Ladmo shows, and she did two recordings for MCI. There are a few samples, but you're right. For the most part, it was a little bit harder.
Quarter after eight. He's 15 minutes late.
In a general sense, when it comes to Phoenix history, how much of a role should this music history play in what we talk about? We often talk about who are the elected officials. We talk about, oh, what were the big resorts then? What was the weather like post-World War II? But how important do you think the music should be in terms of determining the character, the history of this place?
Well, I suppose for most people, it's determined by the hits. You know, the Rebel Rousers, The Fool, which many people do recognize. But for me, the richness is in the didn't happens. When I look down shelf after shelf after shelf, to me, it's dreams, Steve.
John Dixon, Arizona music historian. Johnny D, thanks for coming in.
Great, Steve. Appreciate it.
When he called me for a date, didn't think that I would rate. Ooh, please don't break our date. I've known lots of boys, through all the tears and all the joys. Didn't think he'd be a guy.
Since the thaw in relations with Cuba, everyone from U.S. airline companies to major sports franchises have expressed an interest in greater cooperation. Whether in tourism, arts, or business, many are poised for the day they can operate in a more open Cuba. This week, the U.S. Secretary of Commerce visited the island to discuss recent measures approved to mitigate the impact of the embargo. One area to benefit first from the new relationship could be medical science, specifically cancer research. Cuban scientists say they've created a vaccine for lung cancer, which has shown encouraging results in early-stage trials. Now U.S. researchers want to develop it further. The BBC's Will Grant reports. And we'll have the story from Will Grant for you hopefully very soon. Checking Valley traffic at this hour, 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident at Shea Boulevard, 101 northbound also, a bit south of there, an accident at Indian School. I-10 eastbound, a collision at the 60, that's on the side of the road. Same goes for I-17 northbound at Peoria. Partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a 20% chance of rain. Same goes for tonight. Partly cloudy, 20% chance of showers. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. Mostly cloudy skies, at least for tomorrow morning, turning a little bit sunny in the afternoon. 30% chance of rain. Look for a high of 69 degrees. Some increasing clouds over the KJZZ studios here in Tempe. It's 78 degrees at KJZZ at 252.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera, performing Florencia en el Amazonas, an epic mystical journey down the Amazon River. Inspired by Gabriel Garcia Marquez's magical realism, Florencia opens November 13th in Symphony Hall, azopera.org.
In a check of the news from KJZZ, the Arizona Attorney General's office has shut down a fake veterans charity in the Valley that's responsible for scamming seniors. KJZZ's Will Stone has more.
The Attorney General's office learned about the telemarketing scam primarily from the children of victims, who were typically elderly, suffering from Alzheimer's disease and other memory-related disorders. The callers would convince them to purchase household products for a markup of 1,800%. The three Phoenix companies cited are all owned by a man named Robert Foster. Attorney General Mark Brnovich says Foster's businesses, based in Arizona, would target vulnerable seniors across the country, falsely claiming the money would help disabled or disadvantaged veterans.
They basically preyed upon people that didn't have the ability to fight back. I think it's absolutely despicable. It's unconscionable.
Brnovich says he plans to introduce legislation in the upcoming session that will help law enforcement crack down on telemarketing scams such as this one. One loophole being exploited by scammers, Brnovich says, is that out-of-state charities don't currently have to register with the state when they call people here. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Harley-Davidson of Scottsdale will be opening its new store this weekend. It bills itself as the largest dealership in the world. And to celebrate, it's running a new commercial.
In a city filled with collagen lips, Botoxed faces, and fake boobs, you could use a little real.
It's called Real, and it's the work of Big Yam, the Parsons Agency. That's Parsons, as in Bob Parsons, former CEO of GoDaddy, which was known for, let's say, talked about ads during Super Bowls. Marianne Curran is CEO of Big Yam, the Parsons agency.
As you're probably aware, Mark, our owner, Bob Parsons, is no stranger to controversial advertising. And he said many times in the past, which we firmly believe, that we don't believe in wasting a client's marketing dollars. So with that in mind, our team, our creative team within Big Yam came together to create what we thought was a memorable, unique commercial to get people talking about Harley-Davidson of Scottsdale.
How would you describe this commercial?
I describe this commercial as kind of meant to be tongue-in-cheek. As I look at it, there's nothing more real than Harley-Davidson, and we thought that it would be an interesting juxtaposition, kind of based off what some folks have said about Scottsdale. And we thought, at the end of the day, it's going to get people talking about Harley-Davidson, which is the main point of advertising. In fact, we think that it's really the only point of ever creating an advertising a commercial is to get people in your door, to get you to ring the register, and ultimately to have them come back as a repeat buyer, a repeat shopper.
Was there any thought during the process of putting this together that, boy, you know, we may be seen as insulting the city in which we're doing business, maybe we shouldn't do this?
We did anticipate that some folks might not be happy with the message. But my philosophy, my personal philosophy on that is lighten up. Life is too short. We shouldn't take ourselves too seriously. So it's meant to be fun. It's meant to be tongue-in-cheek.
Have you gotten complaints from Scottsdale residents or others?
Surprisingly, very little.
To what do you attribute that?
I think that in this day and age, people are able to have fun with different advertising messaging. They almost look for it in some of the advertising that they see. And they want to have something interesting to talk about, so they don't mind that it might push the envelope a little bit. It might be a little edgy, a little controversial. So I think they're starting to embrace that more.
Do you expect that by having run this commercial in anticipation of the dealership opening that more people will come in?
Absolutely. That most certainly is one of our goals, to increase traffic to Harley-Davidson and North Scottsdale and move more motorcycles.
Is there a concern that folks who maybe had been interested in a Harley, who maybe have had plastic surgery done or Botox or something like that, might have been turned off by your commercial?
That's nothing that we've seen so far. We've been in close communications with the general manager over at Harley-Davidson of North Scottsdale and keeping in close contact with any feedback that we've received, and no indication that that's been the case.
Marianne Curran is CEO of Big Yam, the Parsons agency. Marianne, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Sadly, we can't travel back to the Cretaceous period and record actual dinosaur sounds. So a grad student at ASU settled for the next best thing. Courtney Brown created a Carithosaurus skull that was one of the duck-billed dinos so she could simulate the sound it might have made when it walked the Earth more than 70 million years ago. She blows through a device to send air through the skull's nasal passages.
So this is like two skinny balloons attached to two brass tubes. But also, you can get very deep sounds with those too.
This might be a good time to mention Brown is not studying paleontology. She's actually studying interdisciplinary media and performance at ASU. And yes, she does play the dinosaur.
So I call it RAR. It's a musical instrument. So you can play it like a musical instrument. It makes different kinds of sound.
Brown got the idea while visiting a dinosaur museum where she heard recreations of dino calls based on CT scans of fossils. Her musical mind thought, why not make one of those fossils playable?
That would be the interesting part, is that I could make the skull and larynx and it could be a physical thing. When you blow into the dinosaur, in a sense, you can become the dinosaur, much in the way when you like know how to play an instrument, you play an instrument, that instrument becomes a part of you.
The project received an honorary mention at the 2015 Pre-Ars Electronica, a competition for the fields of digital animation, art, culture, and music. Brown also travels with the skull to perform on stage.
Occasionally I can get like real melody type things, which is something that's only happened over lots of practicing.
She's headed to Virginia this week to perform a piece called How to Speak Dinosaur Courtship. It's an imaginary meeting between the Carithosaurus and a tuba. Here's a little bit of that offbeat romance with David Earle on tuba. You can see video of this performance at the show, .kjzz.org. Make sure you're with us tomorrow morning at 11 for KJZZ's Here and Now, a recap of today's elections, bonds and overrides in school districts across the state. Also, legendary journalist and author Bob Woodward on his new book dealing with the Nixon White House. That and much more tomorrow morning at 11 on Here and Now. The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Holben. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Children's. Businesses can choose a health plan with Phoenix Children's to ensure their employees' families are covered, with a group of pediatricians and a care network that spans the valley. PhoenixChildrens.org.